Okay, let's get started. How much are you going to pay for this guy?
104.
Yes, smart guy. So anybody else know? This is a sculpture of an emaciated man walking away, and it just got sold for $104 million. Right? So if you can make these kinds of things, you don't need this class. Right. So, what? I guess this guy is a Swiss sculptor. He never saw emaciated man in his life. So he hasn't gone to Haiti or something. But anyway, but it's $104 million. That's interesting. Okay. So I think it's the most anybody ever paid for a piece of art. The one before that is a Picasso, which was $100 million. Although with inflation, I guess that might be better. So let's do some sanity check based on what we did last time. So if I have a pair of documents whose Jaccard similarity is zero, what would their vector similarity be? I mean, if you don't say anything, I'll start making this into a real quiz. So you would actually have to do it. If you have a pair of documents whose Jaccard similarity is zero, what would their vector similarity be? What? Zero. Zero. It'll still be zero. Yes, it'll still be zero. Okay, what yes? What? No, man, vector similarity meaning we have decided that when you are computing vector similarity between documents, we assume that they're orthogonal anyway. There's nothing different, you know, we are not going to re-orthogonalize them. So what happens to the cosine or vector similarity of a document D with respect to a query Q, the standard one, okay, that we talked about, if the document D is, so basically I computed the similarity between D and Q first, and this is some number, okay. The question is, if I now double the size of the document, what would be the similarity? No change? Okay. What if I just double the first half of the document?
There would be a change.
There would be a change. What if I just randomly permuted all the words in the document?
There won't be a change.
And you have to keep this in mind. This is basically the basis of your retrieval. You are assuming that Shakespeare in any randomly permuted order is still Shakespeare. Okay? I mean, as bad as Shakespeare can be, for those of you who don't like iambic pentameter, imagine trying to randomly permute the words and try to read that. Okay? And as far as your vector similarity metric is concerned, they're exactly the same. Okay? Now, we talked about two measures. We talked about two measures. One is TF, the other is IDF. Okay, which of them is a local measure and which of them is a global measure? Which one depends only on the document and which one depends on things other than the document? If both are local, that's fine. Okay, so that's something that you want to understand. IDF is a global measure. So what happens if I have a corpus of documents, okay, I computed their TFs and IDFs for them. Now I increased my corpus. I bought a few more documents and threw them into the corpus. Are the TFs going to change? No, you just need to find the TFs for the new documents. The old guys still remain the same. What about the IDF? Completely changes. I mean, it can increase, it can, well, actually, it can only reduce, basically, right? Because, it can also increase it. If you add enough large number of documents such that what is sort of common in the first five documents becomes quite uncommon in 105 million documents, then the IDF would improve. Okay, if the new documents that came in have this word much more common, the IDF will reduce. Either way, the point is IDF has to be recomputed anytime the corpus changes, if you are serious about it. Okay, which is okay, it's not a big deal if you have a nice brick and mortar library where books are bought only when the city government does not have a budget deficit, which is basically never. Okay, so you bought some books in 1940s and you don't have to re-index them again. Okay, but if you are on the web, then people are adding more and more documents every 3 minutes, right? And so the IDF has to be recomputed. You know, what was, like for example, the word tweet, right, was a reasonable word less than 2 years back. It has a high IDF because not everybody was using the word tweet. Now if you try to use tweet, it has no use because everybody is talking about tweets. Okay, what happened? Because it lost its, I mean, it became too common, it became too plebeian a term, and so its IDF has reduced. Okay, and so obviously these index, basically the TF IDF values have to be reconstructed. TF doesn't have to be, but IDF has to be reconstructed. Even if you don't move, by changing the other guys, your weights are changing. So IDF, and this is exactly the whole point of the Alibaba story, right? You did not touch the door on which the mark X was made. You went and added X to everybody else's door. Okay, then you made it common. Okay? So make sure that, you know, these are some of the things, just, you know, ask yourself these kinds of questions so you know whether you understood it or not. So are there any other questions about this stuff? Yes.
Sometimes the search engine is not updated with your website.
Yeah.
So that if someone uploaded a new document,
yeah,
on that page, on that website, but the search engine is still showing that.
Yeah. But how much are you paying the search engine to make sure that they crawl? Zero. And you get the same service that you pay for. So basic point is, we will get to this little later, but you know, search engines have to crawl to decide where the what the new documents are. That's a big deal for web. And the crawling frequency is different for different sites.
Sometimes
okay?
The link we appear, that is dead link.
Yeah. But that's just the way it is, you know. I mean, in fact, that basically points out that web, while there are analogies between web and libraries, there are also many places where the analogies break down. This is a perpetually changing library where books keep disappearing, okay. I mean, more than the number of books that disappear from Tempe library where people just steal books, okay. And new books keep coming in. And the contents of an existing book change because it's your page and you just start adding more stuff. Whereas in a library, the book basically is what it is. It's not, unless the second edition comes, it's not going to change. So all of this, when you actually wind up doing IR on the web, a big question is crawling. We will talk about this when we talk about IR versus web, IR on the web. And the crawling, how fast do you crawl? How often do you crawl different sites? Those are interesting questions. And that's ultimately what answers whether or not they care that you change your, you know.
Marketing meaning
what?
Marketing.
Yeah, no, I mean, we would get into the marketing part separately, but this issue of which pages are going to be, which pages, when they change, will get crawled right away versus which pages will be crawled maybe every 6 months. You know, that is something that the search engines decide based on, you know, various things such as importance of the page, which they compute themselves. We'll talk about all this when we talk about crawling. Any other questions? Okay, so the good news is that you are ready to start doing project one, because project one, task zero is really nothing other than, you know, download the code and try the Boolean similarity, okay? And task one essentially is implementing vector space model for the document, vector space similarity computation for the document, okay? And to do that, you already know how vector space similarity is computed. It's dot product divided by the magnitude of the query and the document, okay? And so the normalized dot product. And the other thing, of course, is how are these documents indexed? Okay, so right now, up until now, if I give you a query and a document, you know how to compute the value. Okay, but your corpus has large number of documents, and clearly now we'll do some 310 stuff, the data structure stuff. I mean, there are efficient ways of doing things and very inefficient ways of doing things. And we'll learn a little bit about efficient ways of doing indexing and retrieval today. Okay, and that's connected to this task. So pay attention, and you know, and then you can start doing your project one. Okay. Okay. So efficient retrieval. So let's start. Always think about the dumb idea first, so that you will appreciate the smarter one, right? So what's the normal obvious idea, which is basically, first of all, you can realize that the document can be seen as you know, a vector of weights in the space of terms. Okay, these weights can be TF times IDF. Okay, in fact, we'll talk about when do you compute TF and IDF, you know, at the discussion that we just made about the fact that IDF is a global measure should make you wonder whether or not you should pre-compute IDF and TF and multiply them and store them as weights, or should you just compute the TF and recompute IDF as and when needed. Do you guys understand what I just said? Okay, because if you just store the weights, weights are TF times IDF, but then every once in a while the index keeps changing. And when the index changes, the IDF part of the TF times IDF has changed. Okay, so rather than remember these weights as static weights, you might just remember the TF part and recompute IDF as needed, or every once in a while recompute IDF, or there are variations of these you have to do. Okay, but we'll get to that in a little later. For now, let's assume we just computed the weights statically, you know, TF times IDF or something, and put it in there. Okay, the only other thing I'll remember for each document is also the inverse of its size. Why is that useful? Because you need to divide the dot product by the size of the document to get the normalized similarity, right? Okay, so if I have this, then I have everything needed to compute that similarity of document and the query. Okay. In fact, when you have a single query Q, what's interesting is I don't even really need to compute the size of the Q and divide it, because what I need is a ranking, right? And for the ranking, for the D1 will be, you know, the dot product by D1 and Q1, and the D2 would be its dot product by size of D2 and Q again. Okay, since both of them are being divided by the same Q, if you don't care about the size of Q, you can still, basically, you can just look at the relative sizes and rank. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because you'll never really be comparing how close am I to this query versus this other query. You are given a query and you're trying to rank the document with respect to that query. So you don't really need to divide it by the size of the query. Okay, so everything you need is here. Okay, and Wij is the weight of the term, jth term in the document I. Okay, that means that's basically what I'm thinking. Okay, and now interesting thing, of course, is most documents are much smaller compared to the size of the, so in fact, one new word you want to talk about is, till now we talked about document corpus. We talk about the query. The other thing is the set of all possible words that can make up either the query or the document. Okay, that is of course your lexicon, our fancy way of saying dictionary. Okay, so you have a lexicon of words. The queries are made up of some words from this. The documents are made up from some word, bag of words from this. Okay, but obviously your lexicon would be much larger than the document. I mean, in the sense, any given document probably would not have all the words in the lexicon. It will only have a small fraction of the words in the lexicon. So the interesting point to realize is that this matrix that you are looking at, it's going to be a sparse matrix. A sparse matrix is one which has most entries zero. Okay, because it's a sparse matrix, it turns out that the obvious way of handling this matrix might be hugely inefficient compared to a slightly different way. Okay, so what is the obvious way? The obvious way of handling it is take the query, okay, which has the following words q1 to qn, and each document is basically the term and its weight, okay, and then just compute the similarity for each document and the query. So here is a little pseudo code. Okay, so you initialize all the similarities for all the documents in the corpus to zero. Okay, and then for each document di, and you know, for each term tj, if it occurs in, basically you are computing for each query and the document, you are computing the similarity. Okay, now the interesting thing is this for loop is over each document, which is what you would think makes sense up front, because you have a bunch of documents, you need to compute their similarity. So let's just run through all the documents. Now obviously that's a dumb idea, because the number of words that occur in the query are much, much smaller than the number of documents, and most documents don't contain any of the words in the query. Okay, now if a document doesn't contain any of the words in the query, you will find that out, and you will basically, its similarity won't change in the inner loop, but you wasted time going through the loop anyway. Okay, you will run this loop once for each document. Okay, the worst thing that you can do in an algorithm is basically to actually go through the loop only to find that the result won't change. It's better not to go through the loop. Okay, and to not go through the loop, what you need to do essentially is, rather than loop over the documents, you loop over the terms. Just consider the terms in the query, and then ask for each term, which are all the documents you are occurring. Those are the only documents whose similarities would be changed. And if there are, you know, most queries, thankfully, for in fact Webb's type of queries, most queries are what? 2.1 words long. Even if you are an IR person, maybe they'll be 10, 15 words long. Okay? That's still much smaller than the number of documents. So you would just iterate once for each term, okay, and then for each term, whenever you get the term, what you need is all the documents in which this term occurs. Okay, and then when you go to those documents, then that document will tell you what is the weight of this term in that document. Okay, then you will essentially compute the dot product. I mean, so basically you will then take that weight times the query thing. Okay, in fact, since assuming that the query actually has terms just represented once at a time, then the query weight is 1 for each term, okay? And the document weight is TF times IDF. So you just add TF times IDF of that term to the similarity of that document. And when you run through the list of all the keywords, then by the end of that, all the documents which actually have their similarity changed would have their similarity changed to the correct number. And most documents would never have been touched, so they remain at 0. Okay? It's a very simple idea. This is the kind of thing you have to do having done 3-10, right? Because that's the whole point of writing efficient algorithms. Okay? But to be able to do this, what you need is some pre-processing. You need the ability to tell very quickly what are the documents in which the word is occurring. Because the dumb way of doing this would be, as soon as I ask you what are the documents in which this word is occurring, then you will quickly linear search through all the documents looking for the place where this keyword is occurring, which would be worse than the original idea, right? Because you are essentially going through the document corpus once for each keyword. Okay, so instead, and furthermore, you'll be doing this for every query. So instead, what you do is you amortize this cost by going ahead and constructing an inverted index up front. Okay, the inverted index essentially tells you for each word in the lexicon, what are all the documents in which it appears, what are all the positions in the documents in which it appears, as well as what is its weight in that document. Okay, now in fact, to compute just the similarity, I don't need the position. It turns out that the positional information is useful if you want to do other things. For example, one of the things we did not consider up until now is if I am looking for the query computer science, right? And if I have two documents, in one document the word computer and the word science occur next to each other. In another document, the word computer occurs in the first paragraph, the word science occurs in the seventh paragraph, and they never occur together. Clearly, you would like to say that the second document is less useful than the first document for the query, less relevant than the first document for the query. To do that, you essentially need to talk about positional information between the terms. We haven't talked about it until now, but this is something we will add eventually. Okay? And to be able to do that, it's useful upfront when you construct the index to remember the positions of each of the words in the document. And then you can essentially get the position postings of each word in the document. The computer is occurring in this document in position 6, position 9, position 25. Okay? The word science is occurring position 7, position 10, position 26. Good stuff. Or science is occurring in position 100, position 200, position 300. Not so good, because it's occurring very far away from the original, the other word. Okay? So you would keep the postings list to have the positional information too. And this is the construction of inverted index. And once you construct it once upfront, then you can have a much better version of this running. Okay, that's basically what we're going to do. Okay, so method one is not efficient because it needs access to most non-zero entries in the document term matrix. Basically, it's not exploiting the sparsity of the matrix. Okay, so the solution is the inverted index, and as I said, inverted index is actually the only index you guys know. What we call index in the back of the textbook is the inverted index, which is telling you for each word where, which particular chapter is this word occurring, right? So keywords would be, and then you have basically the words and the page numbers in which they occur. That's what your inverted index tells. The normal version, that's what a textbook index will tell, and we actually will compute something which is more directly the position. This is the 15th word, this is the 17th word, this is the 19th word, okay? So the overall idea of the search for retrieving a document now would be, given the query queue, which has, let's say, computer and science, you go to the lexicon, which is the dictionary, okay, except it's not the Webster's dictionary. It's the dictionary for your corpus. Okay, and tells you what are all the words that are actually appearing anywhere at all in your corpus. And all the lexicon is going to tell you, all the lexicon is going to tell you is essentially a pointer to that word's entry in the inverted index list. So most likely what you would do is you would represent the lexicon as a hash table. Okay, so you would hash into the lexicon, find the pointer for the term, and then use that to index into the inverted index. And the inverted index will then tell you for that word what are all the documents it occurs in and what are all the places that word occurs in, and total how many times does it occur. Okay? And then once you do that, then you can essentially go to the right, you can first of all compute the similarity. Okay, you can also, as I said, the positional information can be used to answer what are called proximity queries, which is basically what we believe we will get. When we say things like computer science, we hope that documents where they occur together are given higher weight than documents where they occur far away from each other. Okay. But vector similarity itself doesn't do that. You realize that, right? Vector similarity, the moment you say computer science, there are two different words. The only way you can actually make vector similarity do proximity queries without, directly, is to act as if computer science is a keyword in itself. And that's something called noun phrase detection, and you could do it sometimes, okay? But another way of doing it is basically to consider how close they are in the document, in computing their ranks, okay? So here are the inverted index, a few things about inverted index. So suppose I have a following file like this, then essentially I would get an inverted file like this, which is basically saying A occurs in the positions 1, 4, and 40, entry occurs in 11, 20, 31, and so on. Okay? And then I can sort this. That would become the inverted index just for this file. What I really normally need is an inverted index for a collection of files, a corpus of files. So what you more or less have is something like this. So I have a lexicon, which is all the words, okay, the total number of documents. This is one representation. You can make minor changes to this, but the basic idea you need is you need a lexicon which gives you, you know, for each word, it's a hash table. It'll tell you, you know, what's the pointer into the inverted index. Okay, and so here are all the words. This word, for example, is occurring in 20 documents. This is occurring in 3. This is in 1, and this one is occurring in 39 documents. Yes. That's an orthogonal issue. You could, if you were planning to do stemming, then you have done it by now. Okay, so if you're doing stemming, you would have done this right now. One interesting question, since we are talking about this, we talked about stemming and something else, stop word elimination. Is anything we have talked until now, after talking about stop word elimination, we talked about a few other things. Is any idea that we talked after stop word elimination, making stop word elimination unnecessary? Because it, what? IDF computation. Does everybody notice that? Okay. If you're doing IDF, then you don't need to eliminate stop words. Because, in fact, stop word elimination is a sort of a syntactic idea. It just says, it's a language-specific idea. It says the word the is very common in English, so remove it. Okay. A stop word elimination would never have told you that the word tweet is very common. Because tweet is not common in language. Tweet is common on the web. Okay, what you really want is to reduce the weight of the common words. And stop word elimination is a very crude way of doing it. It makes it 0 versus 1. If it's present, it's, you know, if it leaves it in, its weight will be 1. If it removes it, its weight becomes 0. If you do IDF, you get a much better idea, you know, between some number between 0 and 1 possible. It basically has a degree of importance. Okay, so really, stemming you may still decide to do. Stop word elimination you don't need to do, because if you're doing IDF, stop word elimination is not needed. Okay. Again, this is other thing that you want to think about, which ideas are subsumed by which other ideas, because that's the only way you can kind of, you know, in the back of your head, you can make sense of stuff being presented. You know, how are they connected to other things, you know. Okay. So, now, and then there's a pointer. The pointer from each lexicon entry to the record of its inverted index record, basically. Okay, so this one is says it occurs in 20 documents, and then each record here basically says this is the document ID, this is the 34th document in which it occurs 6 times, and it occurs in position 1, position 118, 2087, 3922, and so on. Now, much of this extra information, as I said, you don't really need for just simple similarity computation based on vector similarity, but it will be very useful if you're going to use two things. It will be useful in two different places. One, of course, if you are doing proximity queries. I already mentioned that multiple times. Where else would you need this information? Why would you need the information, the positional information? Yeah, that's the thing. So ask me what's the time. Not what's the time. So the first thing is, in fact, nobody asks what's the time anymore in US. So the first time when I came to US, people will say, do you have time? I'll say, yes. And they'll give me a tough look. Because when I ask, do you have time, you're supposed to tell what is the time. Okay? Right? That's the intent of the question. And similarly, when you ask me, show me the document which have the word computer science, and I just give you, here is 10,000 documents that have the word computer science, and you go find out where they are. That's no good. I'm supposed to prove to you. You know, it's like justice should not only be done, but should be seen to be done. Query processing should not only be done, but should be seen to be done. It's a very important point. Okay, and if imagine, in fact, in the first part of your project, when you get the answers, you will just give the URLs, and you should be really frustrated about that, because if search engines gave you just the URLs, you would be very unhappy, because you have to click on each of them, go through the entire file to see where the words are occurring. Instead, what they do is they compute what's called a synopsis, okay, a snippet of the page, which is basically a way for them to prove to you that there is a part of this file which does contain these words. How do they compute that? They need the position. To take the positions, once they know the positions of the word, then they can go a few words this side, a few words that side, make a little snippet and show it to you. That's my proof, me, the search engine's proof to you, the user, that not only does this file contain the word, but here is one place where they are around. And sometimes you can give a larger snippet which will show multiple places where it's occurring and the context of the word around it. And this is very useful, because then you may decide whether to click or not click on that link. Okay, so that's another reason why you wind up needing the positional information, even if you don't care about the proximity queries. Right? Okay. So this is basically the occurrence index, and you know, it has the number of occurrences and the positions and so on. The number of occurrences is really nothing but the TF. Right? I mean, if you normalize it, it'll become the normalized TF. But number of occurrences is enough information to give you the TF word. Okay? And the IDF then can be computed once you know how many documents actually, in fact, this in itself can be used to compute the IDF. Agreed? Right? Because, you know, if you do all this and there's a total sum of the documents, I mean, you know the total size of your corpus, okay? And then 20 is the number of documents where Jezebel is occurring. So the log of the total number of documents by 20 is its IDF. And clearly, Jezebel is more common word than Jezor. Right? So this guy's IDF will be higher than this guy. Okay? So you have everything with this. And you can construct this. Okay? I believe in first project, actually, you have to understand how the innate indexes are constructed so that you can manipulate them in computing the similarity. Okay, there are a variety of variations that are possible. You know, this is a reasonable representation of the index. There's an entire cottage industry whose only purpose is to construct more compressed inverted indexes, you know, for large document corpuses. We will talk about some of the ideas in this class, but you know, at least this much you need to understand for the project, one part of it. Okay, so here are some ideas. So for example, the address space can be flat versus hierarchical. We'll talk about what that means. You can define TF and IDF either pre-calculated, or you basically just keep the TF separately and IDF computed at the time you need. You can also, one of the other things that you would do when you, this is sort of foreshadowing what would happen later on, is not all positions are created equal. Okay, so for example, if the word computer science occurs in your document, okay, but it occurs in the 17th page, and it occurs in my document, it occurs in big bold letters, you know, 96 font size, at the top of the document, right? Somehow I should win over you, right? And that basically means the positions are not just, not only do you care about where they are occurring, but how prominent are those positions. So for example, if the font size is big, it should count more than if the normal font size, right? And similarly, in fact, so this stuff becomes very easy to deal with in web pages, because getting the font size information, getting whether it's appearing in the header versus footer, those are very easy on HTML files, because those are rendered that way. And in fact, most search engines will use that in such a way that a page which has the keywords in the title, I mean on the header, would have a higher preference than another page which has the same keywords but much, much lower down. Okay, and so you would want to, for example, throw in the header, font, and tag information thrown in. We will get back to this when we talk about extensions to web versions. And you may also want to do compression of the indexes, and you may also want to talk about distributing index over multiple machines. That's a huge big deal, for example, for a SQL search engine. If you put all your index in one place and that machine dies, then you don't have China to complain about, because your search engine isn't working because your machine died. Nobody is really killing your machine. Okay, you need to have gazillion billion copies of this, a large number of copies of your index. Okay, thankfully index doesn't change fast enough, so you keep multiple indexes in different places, and you know, that way you have the ability to answer queries even if a couple of machines with the index are down. So those are all issues, and so index construction is a big issue. I mean, we'll talk about it today, some of it, and then we'll talk about it more as the semester goes on. Okay. So we have an inverted index, and let me just close the loop by saying you can write a little algorithm which uses inverted index, and in fact it becomes faster than the original version we talked about, where it was document centric. Okay. So in this case, what you wind up doing, you know, this is just basically saying that I have a lexicon, and the lexicon has a pointer to the terms entry in the index. And now the algorithm does for each term TJ instead of for each document DI. So the loop is now over the terms in the query. Okay, and by now, since you already constructed the inverted index, this can be done very easily. You have, for each term, you know what are the documents in which it's appearing. Okay, so you had to have spent that time beforehand. Okay, so if you do this, then you essentially compute the similarity of all the documents in which those terms are occurring very fast, much faster than the previous idea. Okay, so this is term-centered rather than document-centered, and you would have to use something like this in your project one. Doesn't look particularly hard, right? Okay, you are given an inverted index, and you need to use it in project one. Okay. So, you know, there are some obvious observations we already made, which is that if a document doesn't contain a term, that it doesn't contain any of the query terms, it would never ever be touched. Okay, going there and finding there is nothing there is no good. Not going is what you need to do to improve efficiency. Right? And so that's what inverted index tells you. So obviously the only non-zero entries matter, and then in some sense you are computing the similarity of all the documents in, so one of the interesting things in this project, in this particular thing, is that the similarity is sort of being in the previous, the original version, for each document its complete similarity is computed, and then you go to the next document and its complete similarity is computed. In this, each term, for each, you are now term centric. For all the documents which have that term, their similarity would be incremented a little bit with respect, because they got this term, basically by adding TF times IDF to the current similarity. And then you go to the next one, you add a little bit more. The next one, a little bit more. Okay? So in some sense, it's basically multiple document similarity is being simultaneously increased in each loop. Okay, so if, for example, you happen to have a query which is 300 words long, and you really don't want to waste your time going through all of them, you can just stop after the first 10 words, okay, and then rank the queries, rank the documents based on that, which you couldn't do in the previous version, because it would have computed the exact similarity of the first 10 documents that it saw, not the first 10 ranked documents in the same time. Okay, so this is a better way of using your time. If you have to stop, then you have something more useful here than in the previous one. Okay? Yes? That's just multiplication. All I'm basically doing is, so I'm assuming that the jth word's weight in the query. Normally the jth word's weight in the query may just be 1. If it is present, it's 1. If it's not present, it's 0. And the wij is the weight of that same word in the ith document. And this is basically computing your dot product. And in the end, I'm dividing it by the normalization factor. Is just the size of the document. As I said, you don't need to because the query is the same for all the documents. Okay, for a single query, you can do it, but the ranking doesn't change. Okay, and you want to avoid doing unnecessary computations. What? No, but for each document which is in the inverted index entry, and not every document is in the inverted index entry of a term T. No, all I'm saying is, look at this. So for example, this guy has only appears in one document, and you will only consider the document number 67 in looking at that term, as against the entire set of documents. If you are unlucky enough to get a term which appears in 80% of the documents, you're in trouble anyway. But you can be smart at that point of time and realize that that term has very low IDF. So, in fact, as I mentioned, you know, you can think of large number of small extensions. As I mentioned, if you have too many words in the query, you can stop after a few words. Now, must you go in the order in which the query is given? No. If I have 100 words, sort them in terms of their IDF. Go as much time as you have, go it with the high IDF words first. If you do that, the one which is appearing in the 80% of the documents would not even be picked. And those are the useless words anyway.
I'm just asking because there are options that a lot of documents could be used in the query.
So
you could easily use a word in the place of a lot of documents.
I understand. But I'm saying there's also a way of avoiding that, which is. Yes, I mean, there are a lot more that's going on. This is for the traditional IR. Okay? So, in fact, in today's class itself, we'll be talking about some of that. Okay? So, as much as, you know, this is this stuff, right? So, compared to the losers in the world, you feel very smart that you have come up to this point. And then, by mistake, you look up and you find that there are smarter people all the way to the top. Right? So, this idea is smarter than the dumb idea we talked about, so we feel superior to the dumb idea. But then this is still not enough, you know, because it still does a lot more work, and so you will spend time trying to improve its performance. And some of those ideas are sort of the things that he was mentioning, but we will talk about it in the class too. Okay? That's the weight of the term in the document, whichever way you want to use it. Assume if you use TF times IDF, then it's TF times IDF. Okay. Okay. So, by the way, so I won't go through this slide, but you get to go through it yourself. Okay. Here is a worked out example. For those of you who are sort of having still trouble in, you know, these multiplications, you know, where here is a query, here is a document representation, here is the inverted index for these documents and the queries, and then computation of the similarity between this query and these documents. And phase by phase, after T1 is processed, then after T3 is processed, because there are only two terms, T1 and T3. And then at the end, what are the similarities of all the documents? And then after normalization, what are the similarities? And you know, then obviously you know what the ranking is. Okay. So if you still have trouble, make sure that you look at this. And you know, I do not want to go through this because it's obvious. No. But you may very well have you know issues, and so you may want to look at it. Okay. So, any other questions on that stuff? What? Are coming together.
Yeah.
So the way to do it, okay, right now I'm not going through that, but you have enough information to figure that out. That was what I was saying earlier, which is, in fact, let's see, in this example, right, the term T4 is occurring in the position 1 in document D2, position 1 in document D3, and position 1 document D4. Okay, suppose I'm trying to look at T4 and T5 as my query, computer and science. Now, in this case, it's occurring in position 1, here it's occurring in position 2. So that means they're occurring together. Okay? Whereas if this is 1 and this is 75, then they are not occurring together. That's one way of doing it. Okay?
Many searches on the internet are supposed to be keywords that will have only high IDF.
let me complete. I'm going through this. Okay. Okay. I mean, I'll get to that basically. That was my point. Okay. Any other questions on the stuff that we have discussed till now? So, the rest of what we are going to do today is to improve this idea. If you understand up to now what happened, then you are set for your project one, part one. Okay. But the rest of this is improving it further. Okay, improving the efficiency further. And even at the expense of not getting the exact ranking. Okay, so I will start talking about some approximate ranking methods. So if I don't want even to do this much work, and I want to look at, do less than this much amount of work, then at this point, when I went from dumb idea to the inverted index idea, okay, I have made sure that it was a lossless idea. It's a lossless idea in the sense that if you did the dumb idea and you ranked the documents, okay, and you did the inverted index idea and you ranked the documents, those rankings will be exactly the same. Exactly the same. No difference. Okay? Now, as we go forward, we will start giving up on that requirement. I don't really mind if the ranking is slightly different. Okay? And that's the only way you can improve further. Now, you might be very worried, saying, my God, what if, in fact, this guy is supposed to be number 7 and my new approximate ranking will make it number 9? Or furthermore, much more interestingly, what if this document's real rank is 2,755, okay, and my approximate version is making it look like it is 3,979? Who cares? Nobody looks at those documents anyway. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, nobody really cares about the full ranking. So in fact, I don't know whether I should say this or not, but there are all these ranking strategies. US News and World Report ranks the top party schools, right? And they'll only show the top 10 party schools. And we're already there. We don't care about paying money. And then they'll say, if you want to see the rest of the schools' rankings, you have to pay $10. Okay, now notice the interesting thing. I told you that InfoSeek tried the same idea. Right, they'll show the top 10 results and they'll make you pay for the rest of the results, and they went out of business. The last I checked, US News and World Report still is in the business. Okay, why is that? Because the people in the top 10 party schools already know and they're confident that they are in the top 10 party schools. Right, the ones who are trying to get into the top 10 party schools would like to know whether we have made it at least to 174th rank. Right? Nobody else in the world cares that you have went from 187th to 174th. But for you, it's a big deal. It's like personal achievement. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, if US News and World Report's ranking were to be wrong after the top 10, nobody else will, the population at large would not be surprised. So, for example, suddenly we are off the party list school and, NAU got into the top 10 party schools, then this would become a big deal because everybody will know that NAU is not as much of a party school as we are, right? And so US News and World Report rankings will go down because it's giving the wrong ranking. Nobody will buy it. But on the other hand, if the NAU's ranking changes from 174 to 165 or vice versa, who cares? This is what I mean by approximate ranking. Okay? And furthermore, all these rankings are made up. I mean, I'm not just talking about US News and World Report ranking, which is completely made up, okay? But the real, this vector space ranking, that's made up too. Because what are we trying to impress? We're just talking about documents as bag of words, query as bag of words, and taking vector similarity between them, acting as if there are vectors in orthonormal spaces. It's like, where do I even start as to how bad this idea is? Right? Do you understand what I'm saying? Right? And so the point is, there's just so many things wrong about this idea. So making sure that you get the exact ranking all the way down to the 3,958th document is not impressing anybody. Okay? So you might as well be done faster. Okay? So in fact, if there is a trade-off between giving results to your user in like 1 millisecond, but you are only sure of the ranking in the top 10, versus giving the same results in 10 seconds, but then you would be sure of the ranking all the way to 1,000, which is an obviously smart idea. just be done with the 1 millisecond. Okay, that's the basis of what we do now, which is basically trying to get some of the ranks correct and forget about the later parts anyway, because most of the people are looking at just top 10 results. Yes, sir. That was always the case in web search, yes. Yes, indeed. No, as I said, the question is which users look for recall versus precision. The point is most users tend to look for precision. And I already mentioned that Donald Rumsfeld would like to look for recall because he wants to catch every terrorist. Okay? Whereas most people just want to know first top few results of their queries. I didn't make the world. The customers are what they are. And given the customers for search engines, precision winds up being important.
So that kind of
and get the result from that. That idea has been done. In fact, you could do that
because,
too.
Because that will be more efficient because it study all the
search engines. It is more efficient if other search engines are dumb and allow you to call them. Okay. Most of these quote-unquote meta search engines, which is what you're talking about, where I don't do any work, I'll call other people to give me results, have gone out of vogue because search engines would stop too many queries from any given URL. Because they want to show the advertisements. You know, why would they be? Again, one other thing is if you are smart, then there are other people who are smart too. You know, this is a arms race. And Google isn't going to make you money. You know, they want to make themselves money. So meta search as a big idea has sort of gone out because, you know, there'll be too many hits from your URL to Google. And at some point of time, Google says, no, sorry, I would blacklist you. Yes. Code questions asked here.
No, it's not code questions.
Mm-hmm.
Ethics question. Basically using the URL connection for plan, you can crawl any website. And if they don't have that robots.txt file in their server, you can hack the whole. I can hack your all your data, things like that, even which you might not want.
Mm-hmm.
So is that ethical in general?
Okay, first of all, even if I have robots.txt, are you going to pay for it? Are you going to actually listen to my robots.txt? Can I sue you if you ignored my robots.txt? Okay. These are interesting questions. We'll talk about it. But, you know, your first project wouldn't have to be worried about that. Okay. These are good questions about, you know, ethics in search engines. Okay. But it's a very slippery slope. Even if you put robots.txt, I could say, I don't have a good enough program. It doesn't understand the it doesn't parse the robots.txt correctly. And nobody is going to sue you. Okay? So anyway, we'll get to that again when we talk about IR with respect to web search. But coming back here for the approximate ranking, we want to further reduce the document for which we compute the query distance. That's the basic idea. Okay? Without affecting the top 10 results too much. Okay? Now there are two possible ways of doing it. And one is query-based idea, and the other type is document corpus-based idea. And both are easy to enough to understand, but you may not have thought about it, but the moment I tell you this, you'll say, yeah, it makes sense. Probably you read this already. So in the query-based ideas, basically look at the query, consider only the important terms, and rank the document with respect to the important terms. This was what I've been talking about all this while. And when you, you could just say top five terms, first five terms, and instead of the first five in terms of the order in which the query is submitted, you could say first five terms with the highest IDF in the query. Where do I get the IDF? From the inverted index. It's from the lexicon, because lexicon will have for each word how many documents it appears in. Okay? If you do this, you know, you can reduce the amount of work you do. Okay, in a 100 word query, you may decide to just rank the documents in terms of the top first five words. Okay. In fact, you can make it more dynamic, obviously. You could just say there is a threshold of IDF. And any word which has lower than this IDF, I'll say it's too common and I won't care about it. And it's a great idea because A, it doesn't change the rank too much, and B, it's exactly those bad words that will make you look at many more documents. You know, the fact that they have low IDF means there are many more documents in which they occur. And so you will wind up doing more work if you actually took them into account. And the benefits are much less. So it's a kind of a win-win situation as long as you are agreeing to this idea of approximate ranking. Okay, because I can always construct a pathological example where the true ranking for NAU is 2074, but you will say it's 2079. Okay, yes, sir.
Would you ever get to the point where something that would be ranked really low on this way would be really, in reality, really highly ranked?
You can do that. Think about it. Talk about it on the blog. Okay, there will be pathological cases, especially for really, really long queries.
But it would be really rare, though.
Yes, that's the idea. Okay? But I mean, these are basically, you have to give up on something to improve the efficiency beyond the inverted index. And you are giving up on the guarantee of, you know, correct rank. Okay, this is one idea, one class of ideas. The other class of ideas, which is just as useful, is instead of focusing on the query terms, focus on the document terms. And so document, okay? And then basically, first compute your first rank. So basically, the idea would be to split the document corpus into barrels. Barrel 1 are the important documents, barrel 2 are the rest. And you can extend this by saying there are multiple barrels. The most important barrel of documents, the next most important, the next most important. Okay? And then you will have inverted index for each of these barrels separately. Okay? And then given a query, you would first rank results in the top barrel. And if you get top 10 results from there, you just show them and stop. If it turns out that you can't even get 10 results with similarity above, let's say, 0, right? Then you go to the second barrel. Otherwise, you go to the third barrel. Now, once again, this idea also can be shown to be, there can be pathological cases where a document from a lower barrel could actually sneak into the top 10 results. And it depends on how you split the barrels to begin with. Okay? Now, why would you split the barrels? So if you are a traditional library, one way to split the barrel would be to say the hardback books with ISBN numbers would be in the first barrel, okay? And the trade paperbacks will be in the second barrel. And so I will give you results of like literature pieces first. And then, you know, the other stuff, which is, what is this, this whole entire trade paperback, such as, you know, the Idiot's Guide to X or the Dummy's Guide to Y. Okay? And that would be fine. I mean, of course, you could say, I really wanted the Dummy's Guide. You know, I didn't want the masterpiece of literature. I really wanted Dummy's Guide to Othello, not the original Othello. Okay? Then you're in trouble. But I have to make a judgment, and if, you know, a reasonable way to split it would be short barrel contains the articles published in prestigious journals, large barrel, the long barrel contains all the conferences which are write-only conferences. That means people write papers in that, nobody reads them. Okay? And if nobody is going to read them, then you don't need to retrieve them. Okay? And graduate students among you know a lot of write-only conferences, because sometimes you write in those conferences, and you cite papers from conferences you read from and never cite a paper from the conference you are submitting your paper to. Whenever you do that, you know that you are writing to a write-only conference, and stop doing it. Okay, this is only for grad students. Because, you know, the whole point of wasting your time and killing trees is the hope that somebody other than you and your advisor will read that paper. Okay? Otherwise, don't waste your time. You know, there are much better ways to make money in life. Okay, so in those cases, you know, look at the citation index of a conference, and if it is like too low, put it in the long barrel. Okay, so that's a reasonable idea. The other idea, in some sense, when I said citation, by the way, that's actually the first, you know, prestigious versus non-prestigious, who decided that? Hardback versus softback is easy to decide. Okay, prestigious, non-prestigious is harder to decide. But prestigious, non-prestigious can be decided in terms of citations, for example, conferences. The reason Shakespeare is considered big is because everybody somehow seems to know about Shakespeare. and they all seem to refer to them. Okay, so it's this reference in human societies, things become important because other people look up to those things, and so it's essentially the citation is ultimately the way something becomes important versus less important. Okay, and you can compute that, and when we get to web pages, for example, in fact, for conferences there are citation indices which tell you which are better conferences, which are less worse conferences. Not in terms of which have the cheaper versus costlier registration, but which have papers that seem to actually get read by people who will write other papers. Remember, I already told you that my papers are actually read by people who don't seem to write any more papers. Okay, citation is a two-edged sword. It not only should be read, somebody who reads your paper should be smart enough to do more work so that they can publish one more paper. Okay, and if that happens, that means it's an important thing, and you know, it's worth putting that in the short barrel. Okay, and the idea of page rank, which many of you already know, and we will talk about, you know, the theory of it a little later, is essentially an automated way of computing this importance in the social network of papers, our social network of pages, our social network of books. Okay, these two are not disjoint ideas. You can combine them. You can split the keyword. I mean, if you have a long query, take only the top three high IDF words and first rank them with respect to short barrels. And only if the user is particularly tenacious and persistent and keeps saying, give me next 10, give me next 10, give me next 10, because they want to see whether their paper is ever listed, right? Right? Then you keep going to the lower and lower and lower level barrels. And when you reach the bottom of the barrel, you tell the poor guy, sorry, we never even crawled your site. Okay? But that's an idea, and it improves significantly the speed of, you know, speed of computation, because to the extent most people only care about the top 10 results, wasting your time such that the rest of the documents are correctly ranked is a waste of time. So you need an idea which doesn't change the top 10 results too much, but might very well change the ranking of the rest of the documents. Okay? Any questions on that stuff? Now, one interesting thing that we mentioned here is, actually, by the way, this is, you know, a lot of people, I guess, in the class already asked, you know, what does Google do? What does somebody else do? And I think I mentioned in one of the emails that nobody really knows what any search engine does anymore. Okay? But 10 and a half years back or 11 years back, there was a paper on Google in an actual academic conference, and that did this idea. Okay, now they may not any longer be doing this. Okay, now one other interesting thing is the following, and let me tell you this story. So how many of you know Carl Friedrich Gauss? Okay, so one guy passes this class, the rest of you fail. Okay, but you're slow. So, and in fact, this story is all about slowness versus fastness. So Friedrich Gauss, of course, is like a legendary mathematician. Right, so, and physicists and mathematicians always had a rivalry. Physicists think mathematicians don't have a sense of reality, and mathematicians think physicists are a little low on math. Okay, and none of them seem to think about computer scientists. That's a different story. But so one time there's a story that says that a bunch of physicists wanted to basically make fun of Gauss, so they gave him a problem, which, you know, this is this bumblebee problem. I don't know, some of you may have heard about it. So there are two trains on the same track 100 kilometers away. In US it's 100 miles away. And then they're coming at each other at 100 miles per hour. Okay? And they're going to crash. And it's like two Toyotas, let's say. And there is a bumblebee which starts from the tip of the first engine, runs at 200 miles per hour, touches the tip of the second engine, turns instantaneously back, goes and hits the first one again, and like this, until they collapse, at which point bumblebee gets killed. Okay? This is a good stuff. Now the question is, how many miles has bumblebee traveled before it got squished to death? This is the question. So they gave it to Gauss, and Gauss right away gave the answer. And the physicists were surprised, and they told him that, you know, we thought you were a mathematician, and mathematicians tend to be kind of somewhat silly, and they'll try to set up the infinite series because you have an infinite series of the amount of distance traveled one way, the other way, the other way, other way, add them all up, you get the total distance traveled. Okay? And they'll try to do it that way, but physicists are smarter and they will realize that what matters is when do the trains hit each other. And the amount of time multiplied by 200 is the distance traveled by the bumblebee. The answer is the same both ways. One case you take much longer, one case you like to take much shorter. And so we thought you were a mathematician, you look more like a physicist, and Gauss, without batting an eyelid, said, actually I set up the infinite series and added it up.
What?
I set up the infinite series and added it up. Okay, so the point of this is this barrel business is needed if you don't have fast enough hardware. Right? In which case you need to make your life simpler. If the hardware is becoming faster and faster, if your infrastructure is becoming faster and faster, most of the things may not be needed. So it's possible that current day Google doesn't have the barrel system at all, because it's setting up an infinite series and adding it up. It means it's basically going through the entire list much faster than it used to be before. I'm not sure, but you know, when you are writing this, this is a great idea, but whether or not this is important depends on how fast your internal hardware is to begin with. Okay, but if you are doing barrel-based ranking, which I believe most search engines still do, because the document corpus size is increasing without bound, there is this question of distributing the index. This is kind of a slightly different issue, which is, if you are, you know, if you actually don't want to put the entire index in one machine, but rather distribute it over multiple machines, how would you do that? Okay, so at web scale, basically the entire inverted index cannot actually be held in a single host. Okay, and furthermore, you may not want to do it, because if that one machine dies, you are in big trouble. Okay, so you need to distribute it over machines, not just, you know, single copy being distributed in multiple places, but the entire, even one full copy of the index may have to be distributed over multiple machines. If you do that, one way of doing that is again the barrel idea. You know, we came to the barrel idea here with respect to the importance of the documents and to reduce the time taken to give the top 10 results. But if you want to distribute the index, you could also do that by barrel idea. So there are two ways of splitting the index. One is split the index by terms. The other is split the index by documents. Okay? So how many of you have ever read a three-volume book which has index? In all the volumes there are index. I mean, there may be like math 1, math 2. And then there's an index in the first volume as well as the second volume. And the index would be talking about both the volumes. Right? Okay. So it's sort of, now the question is, how would you split it? You could split the index by the terms. You could just say the first part of the index has words starting from A to K, and the second part of the index will have words starting from K to Z. The other is to say split the index by documents. Okay, all words occur in all the, I mean, so you, I will, both indices, I mean, all indices will have all the words, but the first part will only show the documents in one barrel, the second part will only show the documents in the second barrel, and so on. Okay, and in fact it turns out that the preferred method is actually splitting by documents. And that idea is very closely connected to the idea we already talked about, which is basically barrels of documents. And you compute an index for each barrel separately. Okay? And so, you know, if you'll notice that the idea of splitting it into barrels is connected to the previous idea, which is which documents go to which barrel, put the important documents in the first barrel, less important in the second barrel, even less important in the third barrel. Okay, so the same thing you're doing, but it's motivated by two different reasons. One reason, to compute the ranking fast. The other reason, to actually split the index across machines, because there is no single machine that can keep the entire index. Okay. One more idea, which is again connected to the reality, you know, beyond traditional information retrieval, is dynamic indexing, which is, up until now we assumed that the collections are static. They obviously are not. They keep increasing. I mean, a traditional library doesn't increase so fast, but web search, you know, the collections will increase all the time. So documents can be inserted, deleted, modified, and how do you manage the index? These are really engineering issues at some point of time. Okay. So one idea is, for example, this, which is maintain a big main index on the disk, and the new documents go into the small auxiliary index into the memory, the newly added documents, and search across both, merge the results, and periodically merge the auxiliary index into the main index. Okay. In fact, this is a reasonable thing to do, because otherwise you would have to reconstruct the index every time you get an extra document. Okay. And B, in fact, one problem you will find when we get to search engines is that search engine, if you define importance in terms of citation, okay, you first should be born before you get cited. Okay, new documents have zero citations. Okay, so anything which looks at importance only in terms of citations will keep saying Shakespeare to every possible query, because he's the only guy who's dead long enough back and has been cited enough number of times. Okay, so if some Grisham writes a new book, and you might be interested in that, and they won't show it to you because it's not been cited. Of course, not that Grisham's book ever gets cited, but you know, the point is that this is a new book, so it may never get up in the ranking. But the users might sometimes want new books too. How does the library do it? How many of you have actually gone to your library? Wow, two extra people are passing the course. Okay. So libraries are those things with bricks and stuff, and then there are actual books in the stacks. Anyway, so what do libraries do? Those of you who went to the libraries, how do they deal with this? They have a stack called new arrival stack. Yeah. And people just keep standing around the new arrivals to see, and only real old fogies go to the back to find the Shakespeare. Okay, all the happening people will be in the new arrivals getting the latest Grisham book. And in fact, libraries actually even charge you for truly new arrivals. Tempe Library says you can rent a truly new arrival book for 15 days at 15 cents a day or something. So this is not a smart idea that only we made up. This is used in libraries too. And again, it's used exactly for almost the same reasons. If it is old enough, it might have gotten into New York Times bestseller list, it might have gotten some sort of a prize, and so you would know that it's a book worth reading. If it's a completely new book, you don't even know it exists, and somebody needs to push it onto your face. Okay? And I'm actually doing this exact same thing, but for a different motivation. I'm putting the new ones in a separate auxiliary index, because otherwise it'll be too hard to put them, catalog them. So maybe libraries are doing the same thing too. It was too painful for them to recatalog every book as soon as a new book arrives, so they put them outside, but you also like it because the new ones get seen faster. This is actually an important problem in search engines, because newly added pages don't get retrieved based on things like page importance, which is statically determined in terms of page rank, let's say. Okay, by separating the documents here the way you're doing, you will actually take care of that. Okay, so I will stop here. Next class, what we're going to discuss is actually a related issue, which is something that many of you have seen, which is you wrote the word that you're looking for, computer science, except you are dyslexic and you wrote computer science. And the search engine looks at you and says, no documents of that kind. Right? Right. Many of us are really bad spellers, and we would like to think of ourselves as dyslexic people, because that looks better than bad spellers. And the point is, how do you deal with this? Somebody has to realize that when you said computer, you meant computer. This is that Lincoln example all over again. Right? And so you need to look for words that are near misses to this word. How do you decide that? Those are tolerant dictionaries. A dictionary which is tolerant of your human foibles and your inability to spell, and shows you the words that you might have meant rather than the words you typed. You know how many of you have seen this happening in normal search? Lot of you, right? These guys at least have the guts to say they spell badly, but the rest of you don't. So the point is that it's done, and it's done extremely fast. We will figure out how to do that next class.
Thank you.